from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The classical literary tradition of India is incredibly diverse. At least 14 different languages, many religious traditions, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, and beyond. Its poetry and prose look deep into religion, the world, the human condition. Much of it is scarcely available in contemporary translation. A huge new project aims to change that. Editors of the just-launched Murti Classical Library of India speak of 500 volumes on their way. The first five have just been released. This hour on Point, another way of seeing the classical literature of India made new. Joining me now from New York is Sheldon Pollack, general editor of the Murti Classical Library of India. The project has been funded with a gift from the Murti family, founding family behind the Indian software giant Infosys. Sheldon Pollack is a scholar of Sanskrit and a professor of South Asian studies at Columbia University. Sheldon Pollack, Shelley Pollack, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Delighted to be here and to be able to talk about classical literature on national radio.
Yes, it is rather
rare.
It is fabulous and wonderful. I'm delighted myself. We're going to hear later in this hour from one of your translators who marvelously and to my complete surprise actually taught me one of these languages many years ago. Narayana Rao will join us, and I'm so looking forward to
it. Remarkable.
I'm kind of ecstatic about
small
it.
Small world.
Yes,
huh?
It is really? A small world. Telugu, who knew that?
Even though it's so vast, it's so small.
How do we get from Infosys and a high-tech fortune to this new project?
It's a good question and quite fascinating in many ways. The actual donor of the funds that have made the Murti Classical Library of India possible was the son of the founder of Infosys,
Narayana,
Rohan Murti.
Yeah. Narayana Murti was the co-founder, I guess, and his father. And Rohan what?
Rohan was at the time a 28-year-old computer science student doing his PhD at Harvard and studying some classical Indian philosophy on the side with my old dear friend Parimal Patil. Mm. At Harvard, and it was at that time that the Clay Sanskrit Library, which had been founded by the wonderful philanthropy of John Clay, who has since passed away, and which published 56 books of Sanskrit bilingual texts, ended in 2009. And I was looking around for a donor and a, as we say in India, Bhojaraj, a patron for our series. And eventually, I came in contact with Rohan, and the rest is now books.
It's fantastic. You're imagining maybe 500 volumes over the next century.
Well, of course, it's entirely aspirational. Yes. None of us will be
it's
here
good to aspire.
disprove me. But actually, that number comes from the model that – something of the model of the Clay Library. That's to say the Loeb Classical Library, which many of us – I was a classics undergraduate, and Loeb was always a sort of – model for what might be possible for the South Asian world. And Loeb just a few years ago celebrated its 100th anniversary and counts now 504 or 506 books. So my thought was, you know, if we are diligent and every year do our four or five books in a century, we will have a vast library of virtually previously untranslated materials for the people of the world in general and India in particular to rejoice in.
Let's think about the Loeb comparison for just a minute here, 500 volumes plus now in a century. But of course, these are Latin and Greek. We understand in the West what that refers to, Rome, ancient Greece. Let's just come first to the definition of what you're covering or imagining you'll cover here. When you say India, you do not mean its current geopolitical boundaries. What do you mean when you say the classical literature of India?
Well, it's a good question. You could say, what is the classical literature of Greek and Latin? In fact, when James Loeb founded the library, he intended it to include everything written in Greek and Latin up until the fall of Constantinople in 1453, I think it was. Mm. And that has changed. The Harvard University Press has a library called the Dumbarton Oaks Medieval Library. What is medieval? There's a new series on China, but what actually constitutes the domain of China or the domain of French? I mean, is part of French-speaking Africa, part of French literary history. So, you know, all of these definitions are challenging. And none more so than the one you just raised, what is the India of our classical library of India? Well, you know, there is a space within which literature, themes, motifs, aesthetic styles, manuscripts, in fact, of well-known texts, circulated for a very long period of time. It bore different names. It had fuzzy boundaries. Sometimes it was called Bharatavarsha. Mm. Sometimes it was called Hindu. Sometimes it was called Al-Hind. But this big space within which literature circulated, including what is today Nepal, parts of Burma even, all the way up to Afghanistan in the northwest and Sri Lanka in the south, where, in fact, some of our earliest Sanskrit poetry was created, constitutes the big domain of the India that we're referring to.
So that's a vast area. There are commonalities here. We call this the classical library of classical literature, but classical, I think to Western minds, means something else, sort of defined by the era of the ancient Greeks and Romans, whereas yours comes right up to 1800 or so.
It does.
You're, in a way, you're redefining classical here. How and why?
You ask hard questions, don't you?
Try.
the classical is as difficult as the Indian. But let me take just a few minutes to explain the sorts of criteria that we use to think about what should be in the library. Now, over the centuries, the people of South Asia in general, India in particular, had their own ways of ranking works. And from as early as the 5th or 6th century, people spoke in inscriptions and in the beginnings of poems of the great poets of the Sanskrit past, for example. And those, let's call them indigenous processes of canonization. I mean, those texts that the people of India themselves over centuries have found to be critical to their aesthetic and imaginative life are going to be in this library. Those are the first tranche of classical texts. But you know, then there are also works, and we've just published one, this absolutely astonishing book we've named Poems of the First Buddhist Women, that have largely fallen off the map of Indian literary history. I mean, this work in the Pali language, which I can talk about later, disappeared effectively from the subcontinent relatively early on. I think there are very few Pali manuscripts in India after the 6th century. Maybe a few wound up in Nepal, but those are anomalous. Where were they preserved? Largely in Burma, Thailand, and Sri Lanka. But this is a work that was produced in the subcontinent, probably in the 3rd or 4th century BC, and that achieves a level of literary power that we simply could not ignore for inclusion in the library. So there's a sort of, shall we say, a sort of scholarly, contemporary scholarly judgment of what should be in this library, even if it may have not been part of the traditional canonization process.
It is powerful and beautiful. I hope you'll read some of that before we're finished with this hour. But let me just ask you about time frame. I mean,
Please.
Where I was trying to go was with Western classics, we think all the way back, you know, a couple thousand years. You're coming all the way up to 1800. Is that because there's a different time frame around what constitutes classical literature in the subcontinent?
Well, we, of course, as you said a moment ago, we're defining it in a way that we think is sensible. And part of the making sense of the Indian literary history is to think about what happens over certain periods. And something very dramatic happens in the course of the second millennium, from about 1000 AD to 1800. And this is the emergence of a whole range of regional languages for literary purposes. So all of these materials, and some of them appear in our launch series, are relatively speaking, relative to the Greek and Latin classics, relatively late, but they are core texts for the literary traditions of South Asia. Now, 1800 itself marks something of a moment of real discontinuity. Mm-hmm. With the coming of colonialism, the so-called modernization of Indian languages, the slow amnesia that is either sets in or is produced by new educational processes, new forms of reproduction of text, printing, and so on, has made the period prior to colonialism something of a terra incognita to many people in the world in general, and India in particular. And that material is decidedly the sort of stuff that we want to include in the classical library. Let me just say one last word about that stuff. There is something about the idea of the classic in the West that it produces, that it's sort of perpetually contemporary, to quote one scholar, or that it's timelessly present, that we can recognize ourselves in an Euripidean or Sophoclean drama. The fact is that Indian texts allow us to recognize our not-self, precisely the alternatives to the way of being human that has become common sense today. Those are the new classics.
That's pretty amazing, and that's exactly where we want to go in this hour. Sheldon Pollack, please stand by. General editor of the new Murti Classical Library of India. It includes Sufi work. We'll hear some of that. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan singing that. It shows up in lyrics in Bollywood today. But from the classics of Indian literature. Listeners, you can join us. Do you have a sense of these great classics? 800-423-8255. Do you see our not-self here? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the classical literature of India, gushing out now in a great new series of translations, another way of looking at the world, the cosmos. I'm reading here from just one of these five volumes, the story of Manu. One of its translators, Narayana Rao, will join us in just a moment. Night lilies that had wilted by day were now sharp and fresh. Moonstones everywhere were dripping wet. Moonbirds feasting on moonlight made love with delight. The pride of the ocean was at its peak. Darkness defeated, fled in fear. Space smiled with a newfound clarity. Shelley Pollack, when you say in these works, new translations of old, some very old classical Indian literature, we will find our not-self, begin to explain what you mean.
Let me suggest that we start with that poem you just referred to, the story of Manu. This is a work that was written at the very center of the court of the last empire of South India in 1520, and it is a vision of political power, but it's a vision of the sort you will never have encountered before. It emerges, the king who ultimately is produced by this narrative does not want to be king. He resists the temptations that his ancestors have been exposed to for 300 or 400 pages. So you get a sense of a sort of moral fashioning of the political. That is where, as it were, the king must rule but does not want to rule, where he is tempted by power but refuses the temptations. It's a kind of highly tempered vision of political life that seems to be, if not completely unknown in the West, then relatively unexemplified in the West.
I mean, not to mention tempered by centuries of continuous lovemaking with three wives in the forest as part of the kind of preparation for duty.
It's truly a phantasmagorical narrative. But remember, this is not the dream of some marginal poet. It is the court poet of Krishnadevaraya himself at the very center of political life in early modern South India. So it is a... It's precisely the kind of complex, unfamiliar, challenging vision that so many of these texts provide us.
These are new translations, and they breathe with a very accessible kind of language and rhythm. I wanted to go first to Sufi and to Buddhist, but we're on the story of Manu. I cannot resist bringing in one of the translators of this book, V. Narayana Rao, professor of South Asian Studies at Emory University, co-translator of the Murti Classical Library version of the story of Manu. And as it turns out, my old teacher of Telugu from the University of Wisconsin, one amazing summer many years ago, very, very precious memory to me. Narayana Rao in Atlanta, thank you so much for joining us.
You're most welcome. It's wonderful to be here, Tom.
It's years and years since we've spoken. I'm tingling. I'm ecstatic just to have you with us here. And I had no idea you were the translator until I picked the book up a couple of days ago. This is just fantastic. And there's all the Telugu on the page. And in all these volumes, Narayana Rao, yours in Telugu and others, you have the original script, which is very unfamiliar to Western eyes, though you taught it to me on the page facing your English language translation. How did you begin to think about the voice in which to translate this, Narayana Rao?
Well, David and I worked on these kinds of things for many times before, and we translated a number of books.
David Shulman, your co-translator, forgive me, yes.
That's right, David Shulman and I. Mm-hmm. And we developed a way of making classical Telugu accessible, expressive, and intelligible to modern English audience. We had to develop a style of writing and develop a style of expressing what was there in the original. It was not easy, but we worked hard at it. And I believe we succeeded at least to a certain extent.
Oh, I celebrate this. I think you've succeeded magnificently. You've got all this wonderful curlicue script of Telugu, which you taught me years ago, and it is beautiful. I wonder if you'd read some for us, Narayana Rao, maybe first in Telugu something, and then it, your English translation.
Oh, it's lovely. I certainly will take the opportunity of doing that. Thank you. I'm reading, actually, if anybody has the book before them.
I do.
Chapter 2, okay. Verse 27. Mm-hmm. This is a description of one of the heroines of the book, Varudhini, who was sitting under a mango tree singing on her veena, and that's how the poet describes her. And I'll read Telugu first.
Okay.
Tatanitam babhoga thavalam shukamulo niyangadattapu kavirangu valana శశికాంతమణి పీటి జాజువారగ కాయలు తుంగకుచె పాళిన తమిళ తరుణాంగుళీ ధూత తంత్రీ స్వనంబుతో జిలిబిలి పాట ముగ్ధులు నటింప అలాపగతి జొక్కి అరమోట్పు కనుదోయి రతి పారవశ్య విభ్రమము తెలుప ప్రౌఢి పలికించు గీత ప్రబంధములకు కమ్ర కర పంకరుహ రత్నకటక ఝణ ఝణ ధ్వని స్ఫూర్తి తాళమానములు కొలుప ఇంపు తళుకొత్త వీణ వాయింపు చుండి. And see how possible it is to bring the music and the lyricism and the sounds and the texture of the poem into anything in modern English.
But it's true, but you succeed, and I think the bridge is, I mean, you taught me Telugu, but you also taught me joy years ago. We hear it in your Telugu there. Let us hear your English.
The red skirt inside the white half-sari that veiled her thigh stern, the glowing moonstone beneath her red. And the gourds of the veena rubbed against her foam breasts as a delicate finger seemed to caress sweet music from her strings. And she was languid with longing, her eyes half closed as if flowing with song. She was lost in making love beyond herself with pleasure, while the bracelets of her hands chimed the rhythm of the song she was singing with expert skill. And there was joy, brilliant joy, as she played on.
V. Narayana Rao, reading from The Story of Manu, co-translated with David Shulman, part of the Murti Classical Library of India. Can you please explain, in this alternate way of seeing, if that's what it is, Narayana Rao, this book is about, in many ways, about political power. It's written by almost a court poet for his king. But the sensuality is so deep and so thoroughly embedded in here. This is new to me as a Western classics reader, if I put on those eyes. Why the central place of sensuality? What does that tell us about the way of seeing the world and even political power?
This book actually celebrates human being. being human at this point of time, perceived by the poets, is more important and superior to him being gods. Therefore, sensuality as a part of human bodily experience becomes a very central point in the story. They invented a new kind of awareness in the body. They described a new kind of being human. They invented a new way of being the interiority of the person, and that's what works the entire poem. In addition to that, Pradhana also talks about the world around which the human being is emerging. Every detail of this world is described very carefully and very much in contact with the world around him. He even describes how, for example, spring arrives and sees how very closely and very minutely describes how a bud appears, and the bud becomes a flower, and the flower becomes bigger, and the whole tree is full of flowers. It takes a whole poem to tell you how a tree blossoms. That kind of an attention to detail, attention to what's happening around in the world, goes along with the way of describing the human being, human being's interiority, as I told before, and human being's sense of the body, which has never been, as a matter of fact, described as you said, sensuously as before.
Of course, this literature in total, Narayana Rao, also includes a work that goes the other way, away from the sensual. Shelley, I wonder if you'd read for us from this Terigatha. This is poems of the first Buddhist women, some of the earliest poetry
right.
by women maybe in the world. And here's a woman going the opposite direction. The world is painful to her.
It's very hard to follow my dear friend Velcheru here. And also, you know, we don't know exactly how these Pali gathas were performed. There are songs as well, but putta shoken aham atta chitta kitta chitta vishanini nagha pakirna kesi cha tena tena vichariham. That's the first line of this poem, which I'll read.
Pali, your lost language, yes.
That's the lost language of Pali, but it was most certainly intoned in a way that we no longer precisely understand. Let me just alert the reader. They'll hear the name Sugata here, which is the name of the Buddha. They'll hear the word Gautama, another name of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
They'll hear the word Mithila, city that's important in the Buddhist narrative. And most important, they'll hear the word Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. So this poem is ascribed to Vasetti. I was wounded by grief for my son, mind unhinged, mad, without clothes, hair unkempt, I walked from place to place, resting on heaps of garbage in the streets, in cemeteries, on highways, I wandered for 3 years, always hungry and thirsty. Then I saw the Sugata going toward Mithila, tamer of the untamed, fully awake, afraid of no one and nothing. Back in my right mind, I worshipped him and came close. Gautama taught me the Dhamma out of kindness toward me. I listened to what he taught. I went forth to homelessness, forming myself with what the teacher said. I knew it firsthand, the blissful state. All sorrows are cut off, left behind. This is their end. Now I understand things. How could sorrow start again?
Sheldon Pollack reading there from the Murti Classical Library of India, Terigatha, Poems of the First Buddhist Women. Shelley, the first lines there just struck me at how extremely modern the sound. They could be the words of a mother of an Iraq war casualty.
Exactly.
I was wounded by grief from my son, mind unhinged, mad, without clothes, hair unkempt. I walk from place to place. But she goes someplace particularly here to a very Buddhist view of the world, which must have been liberating for women thousands of years ago.
As Charlie Halsey, our fabulous translator of this work, points out, these are poems, and we want to think about them, I think, in the first instance as expressive language and aesthetic achievement, but. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they are records of human experience and of, in general, and of women's suffering in particular. And suffering is, of course, the key thing. It's the attempt to end suffering. Sarvam dukkham, as the Buddha said, everything is suffering. It's the attempt to end suffering that forms the core of all of these stories. Now it's true that there is a kind of, as Sanputh said, there's sort of a perpetual contemporaneity in this work. This is a voice that you could hear today of an oppressed, emotionally shattered widow or motherless, childless mother. And that, indeed, is part of the classical world of India. I'm just saying that there is more to simply seeing ourselves in the past when we think about the classes. There's also seeing, as Narayan Rao pointed out, they're seeing ways of being human that are so unfamiliar as to be kind of shocking. And that's something we want to capture as well.
Velcharu Narayana Rao, the then young, still young, heir to fortune, Rohan Murthy, who is the patron of all this, grew up very well educated, Indian, but reading Robert Frost and T.S. Eliot and Dickens and Shakespeare. Do young Indians know this literature widely, Narayana Rao?
Well, that's a little difficult to answer because there are people who are very well versed with this literature. But young people, as Shelley had pointed out some time back, young people are not coming to this literature as well as they used to before. Something has happened. Most of them are towards technology and towards computer sciences and all that. And very few people are reading these classics. My hope is, and Shelley's hope is the same, that these books will generate a new kind of interest among the young people to go back to their classics. There are older people, middle-aged people, who are very good in understanding these texts, all right, but the very young generation is not accepting them and going back to this text as they used to before. I think things will change, and this series of books may cause such a change. That's my hope.
Shelley, first audience here, Indian or non-Indian or everybody now, global?
Well, you know, we have three first audiences, if I can put it that way. We have the general reader, we have the student, and we have the scholar. We want to produce the kind of translations that Narayana Rao and Shulman and Halasi and Christopher Shackle and Wheeler Thaxton and Jack Hawley have produced in these first five launch albums. These are really they're stunningly accessible, and that is what we want to be able to produce in order to and to bring in the general reader. The student is an essential part of our mission. There's a sort of deep pedagogical impulse here. I mean, that's in part why we're printing the original text in the original script. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that students will take the weekend it often no more takes than a weekend to learn this script. And then the scholar as well. People in India are our audience, but also people across the world.
Sheldon Pollack, general editor of the new Murthy Classical Library of India. Please stand by in New York. Velcharu Narayana Rao in Atlanta, Georgia at Emory University. My old teacher from Telugu days. So great to have you here. We're looking at the classical literature of India. Listeners, you can join us. If we all read all 500 of these one day, would it remake our view of life? How? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the classical literature of India gushing out now in a great new series of translations. It is the Murthy Classical Library of India, the first five of what may be over years and years, 500 from this great body of ancient and not so ancient literature, but all classical. Sheldon Pollack is with us, general editor, professor of South Asian Studies at Columbia University, joins us from New York, and with us from Atlanta, Georgia today, professor of South Asian Studies at Emory University, the great Velcharu Narayana Rao. once my teacher of Telugu, who's along with David Shulman now translated the story of Manu from Telugu into a beautiful English translation in one of these first five volumes. Jim is calling from Massillon, Ohio. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and gentlemen. 30 minutes ago, I knew exactly what I was going to say. You've covered so many things now. These books came to my attention two ways, through the study of the Transcendentalists long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Thoreau and Emerson, of course, make reference to the Gita and Upanishads, and
mm-hmm.
Not maybe to Vivekananda. I haven't heard you mention that name yet, and Patanjali, and a lot of other things. Just to take it to a level that some people maybe can connect with a little bit better than some of the erudition that you discussed just recently with dialects and all. Joseph Campbell is a great connection to these works. And quantum theory, actually, my background is in physics. The idea of quantum mechanics, quantum theory, and so forth melds quite well with an awful lot of the deeper thoughts, mm-hmm. the idea of the oneness and of the energy of which we're all a part, the substrate energy and so forth. So this is a very interesting discussion. I don't hear a lot of these kind of discussions in northeastern Ohio, and I do hope that the folks that are listening to this show will give these translations, these works, a tumble, even if they're not, if you'll pardon my Sanskrit here, ekam sadvi prabhuda vedanti, that which is one, although the sages call it by various names. I think that people can get in touch with a real, a primal reverence and an endlessly nourishing source by going to the ancient books of the East.
Jim, bravo. Thank you very, very much for that. Shelley, it makes me want to ask, you know, our Western sense of this body of literature has been widely shaped by those who first brought it to us and what they chose to bring to us. The Transcendentalists paid a lot of attention to South Asian literature, but I suppose they put it in one frame for us as Westerners read more deeply and widely into this. And this is a huge span from Persian to Muslim and Sufi and Hindu, of course, and right on across. Is there a bigger palette that will unfold for them that may give them a different sense of the total here, Shelley?
I think the questioner, thank you very much for the interesting observation, by the way. The questioner actually touches on a couple of issues that are worth emphasizing. One is that for most of the earlier history of Indian studies in the United States, the texts that were celebrated as central mm-hmm. were Sanskrit in the first place and religious texts in the second, and the history of Indian literature and Indian thought is much, much bigger than what can be comprised in that relatively small box. And the Murthy Library wants to be able to demonstrate that. But by the same token, there are extraordinary works of Sanskrit intellectual history, science, philosophy, and the rest, which will be making their way into the Murthy Library. We are actively commissioning texts on philosophy, on literary criticism, even on science, mathematics, and the like. So among these 500 books are going to be some of the most extraordinary contributions to the history of human consciousness, more broadly viewed than the first five books may suggest.
Where's your mind going, Shelley Pollack, when our caller in Ohio, our physicist, finds quantum theory inspiration in Sanskrit and more?
Well, that's a difficult question, since I know approximately nothing about quantum physics and the
But you can't be a classic scholar of Sanskrit and more without knowing a lot about oneness and with great expanses of time, right? 100,000 years and 100,000.
That's true. I mean, Indian visions of time and the magnitude of the cosmos and the especially here's a poem I'm happy to read for you from Bhule Shah, especially the meaninglessness or the superficiality of of social diversity. Those are values that have been enunciated in Indian works across religious and social traditions for many, many centuries. And those are enunciations which need to be reheard in the English language.
Let us hear it if we can. I think you've got a Sufi poem there that goes straight to it.
I do. Let me read. This is a work of the great Sufi poet, Punjabi Sufi poet Bulleh Shah. Mm. He died in 1758. The work has been translated beautifully by one of the great scholars of our day, Christopher Shackle, in London. This is a hard poem, but the sense of the transcendence of outward diversity and the idea of the divine presence in all things comes out. So let me read this poem for you. Mm-hmm. Bulla, what do I know about who I am? I'm not a believer in the mosques, nor do I follow the rites of unbelief. I'm not among the pure or the polluted. I'm not Moses or Pharaoh. I'm not in the Vedas or in the scriptures. I'm not in drugs or in liquor. I'm not among the drunken reprobates. I'm not in waking, nor am I in sleep. I'm not in joy or in sadness, nor am I in pollution or purity. I'm not of water or of earth, nor am fire or air. I am neither an Arab nor from Lahore, nor an Indian from the city of Nagar. I'm not a Hindu nor a Turk from Peshawar, nor do I live in Nadaun. I have not discovered the secret of religion, nor am I born of Adam and Eve. I have not given myself a name, nor am I found in sitting or moving about. I know myself to be first and last. I do not recognize anyone else. No one is wiser than I am. Bulla, who is the Lord standing there?
Beautiful Sufi poem, and again, as contemporary as can be in that sense.
A very powerful call to transcend the binaries, if you will, that mark out everyday life, and to see what connects us rather than what separates us is a very powerful call. I should also add that this when you hear this poem sung by a great performer, Bulleh Shah, it is truly transporting, and the English translation doesn't quite do justice to that performative dimension.
Of course, those lyrics are so transporting, they still make it into Bollywood, as you well know. Sheldon Pollack, Narayana Rao, stand by. Naeem is calling from Pocatello, Idaho. Naeem, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me. Listening to Bulleh Shah brought tears to my eyes. although you know, it was in English, but given the fact that I've read it in Punjabi, I've read it in Urdu, it truly is transcendental. My point: I'm of Pakistani origin, living in this country for many years now.
Yes.
Being a physician, I'm exposed to the literature that comes my way, but I have a comment to make.
Yes.
The lack of mutual understanding of our commonality, of our common culture in the subcontinent between people who are now divided into many countries, who used to live together for thousands of years, in my view, is the root of lack of tolerance now in the subcontinent.
And by which you mean Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and all the rest of the division.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, what, a few hundred years ago, this mm-hmm. was all the same. Mm-hmm. Pre-colonial times was all the same. Mm-hmm. 1,000 years ago, it was all the same. Interestingly, when you study in a country like Pakistan, you're not given the true perspective of the historical nature of where you come from. Your history starts at Muhammad bin Qasim, the gentleman mm-hmm. who came to India and took it over for Muslims. But anything before that is completely forgotten and omitted from the historical text. And the literature even that is we're exposed to in countries like Pakistan is only the Muslim influence of literature in the subcontinent.
Yeah, yeah.
And we overlook the great Bengali and the rest of the Tamil and everybody else.
It's a tragedy, Naeem. So, it's a tragedy to lose the richness of that inheritance.
Right.
Well, I think that is the root cause. I think that's the root cause of intolerance. I think, you know, like your last caller brought in quantum physics, I'm bringing world peace from this topic. I tell you that lack of that understanding, lack of that literature has led to where you're at this point. Spending millions and bazillions in war and ammunition in that part of the subcontinent rather than building bridges.
Naeem, I'm so glad for your call from Pocatello, Pakistani origin, Pakistani-American perhaps they're calling in. Narayana Rao, my old friend there in Atlanta now, my old teacher, my guru, I should say. What are you thinking as Naeem sees the possibility of reconnection through this classical literature of the subcontinent of peoples who have fallen away into different political boxes now, different geopolitical boxes? Could this have a reuniting effect, Narayana Rao?
At least emotionally and aesthetically, it could be reuniting. Politics probably will produce differences, but if people can go back to what was happening some time back, common languages that are used, same poet writing in more than one language, music connecting them, even now as a matter of fact, I think there is a future, if only people can connect to their past and to their present for that matter. And then it's talking about their culture and their literature and their music and their folklore and their stories and the narratives. Probably there'll be greater unity, seeing all of them together belonging to one large large group of human populations. Probably there is future if that can be emphasized.
One more call, if I may. Suchi in Boston is calling. Hi, Suchi. Thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I'm so glad that you're doing this program and making very difficult concepts accessible to all. I just wanted to say that I live in the U.S. and I've been living here for more than 25 years. And so I find it very difficult to, explain eternal concepts like moksha, karma, Brahma, Shakti, and Maya.
Mm.
So I think this kind of poetry and literary works that you're bringing to light would be so useful for any kind of audience, and Western audience in particular, to be exposed to these very powerful language and concepts.
Suchi, I couldn't agree more, and I'm so glad for your call. I mean, Sheldon, you write the classical is what we find in the text before Western modernity, the different, often radically different ways of being human. Those texts offer us. Give us another example. It's a great, grand, huge idea, but a different way of being human. What would you point to in these first five volumes that might be a signpost?
Well, you know, one way of bringing that rather abstract idea into a more concrete understanding is to think about relations with the divine. And the book that we published, our largest book translated by John Stratton Hawley here in New York and edited by Ken Bryan, De Sur's Ocean, provides a vision of multiple ways of relating to the divine as a child, as a pal, as a lover, as a brother, as a friend. It's absolutely astonishing to see this range of attitudes that are possible for human beings. And that I think to some degree distinguishes this classical Indian world from the relatively narrow range or spectrum of possibilities available in some of the Western religious traditions. And I think Sur's Ocean, which provides extraordinary poetry exemplifications of these ways of relating to the divine, is precisely what I'm trying to suggest by that phrase, radically different ways of being human, radically different ways of conceiving of your relationship to to larger powers in the world.
Let me greedily read one more passage from the story of Manu. Making the darkness a magical ointment for his eye, Time mixed the redness of the rising moon like a wayfarer's blood with white stars to make a dish of blood rice, which he then offered in sacrifice in the eastern sky so he could see the buried treasure of moonlight marked by the banyan in the moon. He saw it and lifted it high, a gift to the god of love. In the story of Manu, its co-translator Velacharu Narayana Rao is with us from Emory University. Narayana Rao, what a joy to have you in my orbit again. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. That's been a great opportunity for me, and thank you for having me.
Narayana Rao. And Sheldon Pollack, general editor of the new Murti Classical Library of India, first 5 volumes out. We will look for more. Hope you'll read with us again. Sheldon Pollack, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom, so much for making this opportunity available to us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.